KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Outside of politics, I think when we begin to think about the common good and act on it in our lives, that's what changes Washington, how we live in our communities, our congregations, our workplaces, our schools.
I've really had great success lately with evergreen huckleberries. The ones that I've planted in as plugs just a few years ago have really made dramatic growth.
Little juxtaposition there of gardening, huckleberries, and Jim Wallace talking about the common good. Jim Wallace is going to join us in a few minutes to talk about his new book, On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. That's coming up this hour on Weekday. I'm Steve Scheer. We'll also hear from our gardening crew and take your calls. We also, you may remember, at the beginning of the hour, last hour we talked to Bill Ifrig about his experience at the Boston Marathon. If you have had an experience, if you're an eyewitness, like to get your story as well, we have on our Facebook page a request at Weekday on KUOW. If you're a witness to the Boston Marathon or you know somebody who is that we can contact, that would be great. We need to get these stories out as history is unfolding. You can also email us, weekday@kuow.org, if you can put us in touch with some of the folks who ran the marathon and were there when those explosions took place. Of course, those explosions have meant increased security around the country, including in Washington State, including in Seattle, where the King County's Sheriff's Department is in charge of security for light rail and for Metro. I asked John Urquhart, the sheriff of King County, what they were doing differently.
Well, from the sheriff's office standpoint, of course, we are the police department for light rail and the bus system. So we have increased patrols in the bus tunnel in downtown Seattle, as well as light rail and the light rail stations. Mass transit in the past has been a target, and we really want to reassure people that we are doing what needs to be done, although we're out there on a regular basis anyway.
How does it manifest? Will people see additional patrol officers? Will they see more people on the trains or buses?
You'll see things. There are things going on behind the scenes that nobody will see. But, yes, you'll see an increased patrol presence. You should see more officers in the bus tunnel, additional sweeps. Those types of things that we'll be doing.
You know, at the same time, we're nearing, there's going to be some more demonstrations. There's going to be May Day. How does this increased activity play into what might even be more increased activities in the weeks ahead?
Well, you know, we have to be vigilant all the time. And anywhere that there are groups of people, whether it's at the Space Needle or the Pike Place Market or the Boston Marathon runs, May Day demonstrations, whatever it is, we're going to be there. As I say, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes, both from an intelligence standpoint and the police sweeps, but there is visible police presence as well. And that's from a deterrent effect, but it's also to reassure the public that we are out there, that we are paying attention, and that we're doing everything we can to prevent what happened in Boston, if we can, from happening in Seattle.
Just on that May Day issue, you saw the report that came out about the preparations by the Seattle police were inadequate initially. Any lessons learned from that as you approach this issue or what happens in the next few weeks?
Well, of course, what happened in Seattle is the responsibility of the Seattle Police Department, and we are ready to help them if need be. We can certainly backfill patrol if they need more resources. I'm pretty confident from my conversations with the Seattle Police that they are certainly ready for May Day, that they're going to do a good job, and I think everything's going to be just fine, as much as there ever can be when you have mass protests.
And Sheriff, when you when something like this happens, how quickly are you notified? How quickly does information get to police departments around the country, and what are they told to do when on alert? What does that mean?
Well, for a couple of standpoints. First of all, before these happen, you know, I think there's an urban myth that the feds don't talk to the local cops. And that's just not true, at least not in Seattle. You know, we have a very, very good relationship with the FBI, with the ATF. We meet on a regular basis. We talk on a regular basis. The reality is, on something like Boston, we find out about it from the press, just like everybody else does. That being said, within an hour of the incident yesterday. I was getting briefings from the local fusion center, so they do talk to us. We do talk to them. We're doing as much as we can from a communication standpoint, and there's so many different police agencies, both local, state, and federal. That's the main thing. We have to talk, and we do talk. We had a scheduled briefing last week of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, the executives that are part of that, talking about known threats, those types of things, so that we are all on the same page. It's really important to establish those relationships, and we've done that.
That's Sheriff John Urquhart, King County Sheriff, talking about increased security at where they are have jurisdiction in Metro and at Link Light Rail. If you are somebody who has firsthand knowledge of what happened in Boston, if you were a runner or you know some folks who were runners, you can put us in contact with them. Do. Weekday at KUOW.org or on our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. We'd like to talk to them and get this first draft of history down. This is KUOW.
It's 11 minutes past 10 o'clock. Conversation with progressive theologian Jim Wallace on the idea of the common good in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from CareForce, serving Greater Seattle seniors and people with chronic illness since 1999. In-home caregivers, nurses, and geriatric care managers work to help many adults remain safely in their own home. More information at careforce.com.
Still some clouds in the sky over Seattle at 46 degrees, but the forecast says it's going to wind up mostly sunny later with an afternoon high of 58. Then partly cloudy overnight, dropping down to 39. Tomorrow, Wednesday, partly sunny with a high of 58.
KUOW thanks the generous individuals and entities who provided matching challenges during our spring membership drive. They include Don and Sandy in Seattle, Edible Seattle, Elizabeth Holmes Travel, KUOW's Board of Directors and Board of Directors alumni, and 33 anonymous Broadcasters Circle members.
Yes, thank you all for your generosity. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:12. We'll get some organic gardening advice in about 20 minutes.
Theologian Jim Wallace talks about the common good in his new book, On God's Side. Jim Wallace is the president and CEO of Sojourners and editor-in-chief of Sojourners magazine. He is a theologian, a preacher, a social activist, a commentator on ethics and public life, a teacher at Georgetown University. He's the author of 10 books, and his latest is On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. He joins us on KUOW. I'm Steve Scheer. Jim Wallace, thanks for talking to us.
Hi, Steve. Good to be with you.
Jim Wallace is in Portland, but he'll be speaking tomorrow night at Elliott Bay Books and Thursday night at the Quest Church in Magnolia at 7 p.m. Well, define the common good for me.
Well, of course, we're all thinking of Boston. I was there just a week ago, Steve. We had a town meeting on the common good in Boston. Wonderful event. And what we saw, what we're seeing now, is such an extreme rejection of this ancient idea of the common good. And then we see in response from just ordinary people, first responders, heroic affirmations of the common good. And I think, you know, in our society we have lost this critical notion of taking care of each other. I took a sabbatical to write this book, and I took 3 months off during the election season. And my discipline was to wake up early and have some quiet, some exercise, and then I would think and read and write all day. But at night, I'd watch the news cycle. And the more I wasn't interviewed, I didn't write, I didn't speak, I was watching it disengaged. And the more I did, the more it really was depressing to see how we're talking to each other. The vitriol, the anger, the fear, the hatred, the shallowness, the polarization, the politicized character of all our discussion. We've lost this ancient but very now timely idea of the common good. It goes back centuries. And the religious foundation is this instruction to love our neighbor as ourselves, but it's also in our secular democratic traditions, the golden rule, treat others the way you want to be treated. And it's so important to lose that is to lose political discourse and lose the ability to solve problems, and we see in Boston, to lose it entirely is to put ourselves in great jeopardy.
Here's my cynical question here, and I'll just start with the cynicism, and you can work me out of it. When you talk about that, I understand it. When you say we can disagree but be civil and seek common ground, I can see that. But if somebody believes that abortion is murder, for example, the most, we come up with other intractable ones, but here's a very intractable one. For them to believe they could seek common ground is antithetical. It's impossible. So how do you walk your way back from those precipices?
Well, the book doesn't suggest that the answer here is kind of mediocre commitments and sort of watering down our passions and our sense of truth. On the contrary, it's how we speak what we believe so deeply. I was in Birmingham 2 days ago. John Lewis, Congressman Lewis, and I opened up a symposium on the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the release of the letter from Birmingham jail from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Here he was in jail. And, water hoses on children, dogs attacking demonstrators, and clergy attacked him and said it was his fault, and he's in jail writing to them. And he wrote with such grace and love and passion for justice. King never said, "I get to win because I'm a Christian in a Judeo-Christian country" back then. He never said that. He knew he had to win the debate about what was best for the common good. That a civil rights law in 1964 was good not just for blacks or Baptists or Jews, but for all of us, and a Voting Rights Act in 65. And John Lewis was there with me, who was just a young man. He was, 24 years old, beaten almost to death on the Edmund Pettus Bridge on Bloody Sunday. And then they marched from Selma to Montgomery, and the whole world watched. And we got a Voting Rights Act. So in the book, I talk about how we've got to win the debate. You don't get to win because you're religious. Religion has no monopoly on morality, none. I'm a person of faith, but I want to say that. How do we, though, invoke our best beliefs, our traditions, King evoked Jesus and Jeremiah, but he also invoked the Constitution and said, we have to win the debate on this. So let's have a discussion about the common good. So the book is, the subtitle is What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. And I think the common good is the right metric. It's the language that we need. And let's have that debate, but have it in a way that respects each other in that discourse.
All right. Well, help me have that debate in regards to when life begins. How do you talk to me about that if I'm someone who says categorically life begins at the moment of conception, and what you're doing, respectfully, sir, what you're doing is morally wrong?
Well, in the religious tradition, there are different theologies in Christian faith, Judaism, Islam, different theologies about when life begins, and not everyone agrees. But there is common ground to be found on many of these questions. The common ground, I think, here in abortion is most people, whether they are called pro-choice or pro-life, most people should be able to agree, let's work hard to reduce the number of abortions in this country. It is, in my view, way too high. So how can we reduce that number? And what works? Supporting low-income women, health care, working against unwanted pregnancies. There are things that we can do that would serve the common good that really would, I think, should be affirmed by those who are pro-life and pro-choice. We're not going to agree on the question you just raised of when life begins as a society. We have a pluralistic country here, and so how can we, though, really work to decrease dramatically the number of abortions? I think we can by supporting low-income women in particular. So how do you find common ground for the common good? We're finding it now in immigration. We're convincing Republicans and Democrats that the system is broken. 11 million undocumented people are going to be protected. That story is in the book. We talk about how we can apply this to the deeper issues than just politics. An economy, I call the uneconomy. It's unstable, unjust, unfair, and it's making people unhappy. And we've broken social contracts. How do we restore what I call a social covenant? How do we deal with the role of government? Not big or small, but what government is supposed to do? What's its purpose, its vocation? Democracy. The checks have replaced all the balances in our public life. The election showed that. How do we break the power of money over politics to restore democracy again? And even in our households, there's a lot in the book about just our decisions as parents and moms and dads and kids in the relationships that are closest to us. Our choices in our households, I think, will really build the common good or undermine it. So how do we really make different choices to, you know, love our neighbor? Do we know our neighbors? Even know who they are? Love our poor neighbor. If you don't know who your poor neighbors are, you're not looking very far, because wherever you are, there are poor neighbors not very far away, or your undocumented neighbors, or your Muslim neighbors, or your gay neighbors. How do we love our neighbor? And that's what makes movements that change politics. And immigration, for example, is a clear example of that. Outside choices are changing Washington, D.C., and the politicians. They're going to actually do something right for a change. By the August recess, we'll have an immigration reform, and they will tell you it's because of the pressure of their constituents in their states and districts that are going to make this happen.
And it's because the Republican Party recognizes that without acting, they won't have a constituency to help them have a majority.
That's true, but this change was happening among people of faith years before this. And so right now, you know, the Republicans who are showing leadership on this are being attacked by, there's a group out there who has $10 million to undermine immigration reform, and they're being supported by evangelical Christians who have been converted on the issue of undocumented people because of what they see in their scriptures. That was happening long before the election, and they saw their scriptures. They have new members in their churches who are undocumented people. They've gotten to know them and their families, and they see the future of the church, including immigrants. And this nation is going through a demographic shift of dramatic proportions. By 2050, most Americans will come from Africa, Asia, or Latin America. And we have to navigate that future together. And that's why the common good becomes so important. Elections will reflect that. But, you know, the old demographic, you might say, is still in charge. So how do we really go to a different kind of future here? And I think this discussion about the common ground for the common good of the congregation, who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor is the question the Gospels are always asking.
Jim Wallace on the common good with us this hour. On Weekday, his book is called On God's Side. Well, where have you seen, let me return to that notion of helping poor women, helping children who are just born to achieve. Where have you seen those ideas put into practice to help them as a way of discussing abortion, in this case again, put into practice in conservative communities?
Well, again, What we do with an issue like abortion, both sides do this. They want to make people afraid of the problem and then blame it on the other side. That happens all the time. Rather than saying, what's the problem here? What are the causes? How can we deal not just with symptoms but causes? How can we really deal with, how can we prevent the number of unwanted pregnancies? Now, you know, we ran a neighborhood center at Sojourners in Washington, D.C. for a long time, and we work with young teenage kids. And you know, I'll tell you what really decreases, sexual activity among young teenage kids, among girls, is self-esteem. Self-esteem. When they believe they have a future, they resist the older boys' stuff. They, you know, young girls, I've seen time and time again, when they sense they have a future, they don't allow that stuff to happen. So how do you really support women and girls who are often the targets of all this? How do we support them? How do you support low-income women economically with medical care? I think health care for more people will reduce the abortion rate. I really do. I think the facts show that. Jobs that pay a living wage. Dealing with low-income women who are stuck in corners really will help to decrease the abortion rate. So people who are pro-choice and pro-life, instead of screaming at each other, should say, okay, how do we really solve this problem that can reduce the number of abortions and do things that we can all agree to? I don't think we've really done that and tried that, and I think we could and we should.
Okay. You have written, though, that the problem here is the last remaining obstacle to democracy is the dominant power of rich people, their money, their institutions, and their control of the political process. Where do you see the common good being able to push back against those dollars?
I've got senators have told me they've got to raise $20,000 a day to get reelected. A day. And they say it with a weary voice. You know, that means who they have lunch with and whose calls they have to take. No time to read the bills they're voting on. This is a serious problem. Both sides are responsible for it. We see primary elections where a candidate's viability is determined by one or two donors. We don't have one person, one vote in this country, not even close. So I think a new generation is going to have to make money in politics a central campaign. And I think it's going to happen over time. It's not going to happen quickly, but campaign finance reform is going to be necessary here. And we'll have to take on, in fact, some rulings by the Supreme Court that I talk about in the book extensively that I think have been wrong. And so how do you really talk about democracy in a deeper way? That democracy in this country was really, you know, landed white men were allowed to vote. That was it. That's how we started. Then all white men. And finally, women, but only white women. Finally, 1965 it took till then for African Americans to be able to vote. And finally then, you know, South Africa, Mandela, and we're all voting. But now money still controls. There are three pharmaceutical lobbyists for every member of Congress. Three. One industry. So right now you have guns. We planted, clergy planted 3,000 crosses, Stars of David, and crescents on the Mall last Thursday. 3,000, because that's how many have been killed by gun violence since Newtown. By the time we got there, we had to plant 3,364. And there were clergy there who had buried teenagers. And one pastor had lost his own son. And yet public opinion is 92% for background checks. And yet we may lose that vote in the Congress because of the power, the outside power and money of gun manufacturers, gun runners. That's thwarting democracy. So we have to talk about this as thwarting, blocking, preventing democracy itself. And so the book talks about what does it mean to move continually toward democracy, truer and truer, greater and greater democracy. And that means breaking the power of money over politics.
But those representatives mm-hmm. you mentioned in Congress, in the House and the Senate, they right. have the ability tomorrow to stand right. up and say, no more of this. You know, yes, there are Supreme Court rulings which restrict some of their efforts, but they have the ability to do so much, and they could do so much. Call it what you will, desire to stay in office, greed, they believe in the things they're being told. What,
right.
if they do believe those things, or if they do feel they need to stay there, what power of democracy, what common good mm-hmm. reaches them?
Steve, you're very cynical this morning. Well, yeah, you're
it's
right.
It's your Here's job to I'm, convince me I'm wrong.
I know. I guess. Well, this book really says that. Let me start there. We can be very cynical about politics for good reasons. I mean, there are reasons to be cynical, and I live there. I can tell you more reasons to be cynical. But finally, hope is a decision, not a feeling. It's a decision we make because of what we believe in, and the book is full of stories about people who are overturning things and changing things because of what they decide to do with their own lives. So, yes, I know members of Congress, Steve, I know members of Congress who would do the right thing, even if it costs them the next election, but I don't need more than one hand to count them.
Right. Oh, yeah?
I don't. So most of them, or a lot of them, would like to do the right thing, but they need the space to do it. On immigration, for example, we're literally creating the space for them to do the right thing, almost enabling them to do this. So how do you create movements? When people come to Washington to lobby, I often talk to them before they go in. I said, here's how you recognize a member of Congress, this guy in a shirt and tie and some women not too. And they're walking around with their finger in the air. And they lick their finger to see which way the wind is blowing. The guy's walking around with their fingers in the air. King and Gandhi knew you didn't change a country by replacing one wet-fingered politician with another or hoping for better behavior from them. You change a nation when you change the wind. You change the wind it's amazing how quickly they respond. Movements change winds. So if we want to be social change advocates, we are wind changers. And the book talks about that. How can we be those who change the wind? Immigration, the wind has changed. The same people who can't reach agreements on guns or budgets or anything else are gonna, they're announcing today, a bipartisan bill on immigration reform. So we're changing the wind on some things. That's what John Lewis did in the Civil Rights Movement. That's what we celebrated this week in Birmingham. And this is about how ordinary people can make decisions and choices in their lives that can change the wind for the sake of the common good. And that will ultimately even change Washington. It has, and it will.
How do you make the space and change the wind in regards to simple gun control changes?
Well, you know, I think, let me just be very basic here. Children are supposed to bury their parents. When it goes the other way around, when parents are burying their kids, something has gone wrong in a society. Clergy are supposed to bury their older congregants. When they're burying teenagers, and I've done that, something has gone terribly wrong. So maybe parents and pastors or clergy will be the ones who change this long term. Right now, the gun lobby, I'm going to call them gun runners because their money doesn't even come from their members. It comes from gun manufacturers. They're gun runners. They're controlling the politics out of fear in Washington. These are people are afraid of being primaried. They're afraid of losing their next election. So all in the long term, though, I think parents and pastors, clergy, ordinary people are the ones who are going to make the difference here. On that mall, we had those crosses, and it was a powerful, powerful visual scene. And I just said to the reporters that every senator, all 100 of them, should have had to walk by those crosses in silence. Just walk by them quietly, slowly, then say a prayer or whatever they do, think about what's important to them, and then go back and vote, you know? So I think this will change over time, but only when we're involved as parents. I've got two kids, 14 and 10, and when Newtown happened, at the next day, we're all on the basketball court with our kids, and every parent was looking at those kids on the court, realizing that it could have been them, every parent. And until we get to that level about what the common good is, we're going to be controlled by money and politics in Washington, D.C. I think, you know, I was there at Nelson Mandela's inauguration in South Africa. I tell that story. There was a lot less hope there for a long time. But Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela, they believed that one day they would breathe free air in South Africa, and then they bet their lives on that belief. That's how change comes. Just being cynical doesn't get us there. But believing that change can happen and then betting our lives on it is what always makes the difference.
All right, sir. I appreciate you talking to us.
Great to be here. I'm looking forward. I always love coming to Seattle, and we're going to have fun the next couple of days in Seattle.
Good.
Great place for a town meeting.
Yeah, it is indeed. All right, Jim Wallace is author of On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. He's president and CEO of Sojourners, editor-in-chief of Sojourners Magazine, speaking tomorrow night at 7 at First Baptist Church and Thursday night at the Quest Church in Magnolia at 7 p.m. By the way, I'm really not cynical, but I do see the need sometimes to step back. So I think I mentioned this once, but I'll mention it again. I'm giving you all 2 weeks' notice. So 2 weeks from today, I'm going to take 5 months off and see if I can, you know, make sure I don't sound cynical. And then come back. Marcy Simon will be here, bringing you the news, all that, all through the summer. This is Weekday.
#10:33. Find out how to make your garden a better place in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Sodo Hydro, specializing in indoor and outdoor gardening supplies and hydroponics, featuring grow lights, Botanicare, Fox Farm, and more. Baker Creek Seeds, now available, located south of the stadiums. Product information at sodohydro.com.
Mostly sunny day on tap with a predicted high of 58 here in the Seattle area. Currently we're at 47 degrees. Overnight, partly cloudy, low of 39, and tomorrow, Wednesday, partly sunny with a high of 58.
Support for KUOW comes from City People's Mercantile on Sandpoint Way and City People's Garden Store in Madison Valley, offering a wide selection of patio furniture and outdoor living accessories. Locally owned and celebrating over 30 years as a neighborhood resource. More at citypeoples.com.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. A federal judge has temporarily blocked Mississippi from revoking the license of the state's only abortion clinic. Our full report in 30 minutes.
Now we garden. After a very soggy weekend, but then we had some beautiful days. So how did that affect your gardening projects? Maybe you have some questions going forward. Greg Rayburn is here, Vashon Basin Steward, working on habitat restoration, salmon recovery on Vashon and Maury Islands, co-host King County TV's Yard Talk.
Good morning,
sir. Marty Wingate is here, writing about garden and traveling, writing about gardens and travel, and writing about
and
gardens
traveling.
And traveling. You can find her works at MartyWingate.com. Her latest book is Landscaping for Privacy. Is there anything else you have to say about the garden plot or mystery?
We are awaiting details.
So we're still awaiting the details.
Yes.
You teased us last week.
I did tease you.
All right. Details forthcoming.
I was teased, and so.
All right. There you are. And Laura Matter has been a practicing horticulturalist for 30 years. That's enough. Garden Hotline Program Coordinator at Seattle Tilth. Nice
morning.
To see you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming in. So you are helping us answer all when we're on the air and we say, oh, you can always call the Tilth hotline, then you have to make sure everybody's ready to go to answer all those questions.
That's right.
That's good. Did you get any good questions recently? Anything that's jumped out at you?
Questions every day. Jumped out at us. Oh, boy.
All that rain? Were people worried
about?
Yeah,
actually, you know, when the hail comes, we get questions about that. So we fielded a lot of questions about how do I protect my newly emerging vegetables from this vicious hail that's raining down on us.
And what'd you say?
Well, covering with Remay, floating row cover. It's a good method to use.
When I was biking home yesterday amidst the smell of the allergies, I smelled cold. It was a little chilly yesterday. Yeah. And I looked at the little buds on my plum trees. Shall I be worried or is that just, you know, par for the course?
It's just cold.
Yeah, well, it's not par for the course. We're colder than we're supposed to be. And I'm sick and tired of it.
And wetter,
yeah.
But most things will be okay, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it.
No.
Just worry about the pollination for your fruit trees. That's what you would worry about.
Yeah. I saw a lot of creatures emerging, though. So.
Oh, yeah.
As soon as it gets to what do you think, 58, 59, 60 for sure?
Mason bees are flying already.
Yeah.
They've been out.
Yeah.
So hopefully flowers that have already been blooming and the mason bees have been pollinating, we're good there. But I'm a little concerned about flowers that got knocked off the trees.
Ah,
I saw a bit of that happening.
Because of the
weather. Because of the hail, yeah.
So, yeah, reduction. Boy, orchardists would really be worried about that, wouldn't they, at this point? I have this very interesting emergence every year of these flies, these native flies. I think they're flies. I've never have quite identified them. They swirl around. They're about, you know, they're about as big as my little finger, joint of my little finger. They're black. They bite. Sometimes you mess with them. So maybe they're.
What are you doing to them?
I'm just looking at them. Well, my kids used to like to catch them.
Okay.
Because they emerge every year right in front of our rhododendron, and they fly and swirl, and they're there for a couple weeks, and then they're gone.
Sounds like bird food to me.
Yeah, bird food, and I imagine they must do some pollinating as they move around or walk around. Flies pollinate sometimes?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
sure.
Definitely.
What about soil structure? If you were digging, for example, and then all this rain came, all that sort of soil that you had moved and dug and then got rained on, that kind of gets ruined, that structure, doesn't it? What do you do for soil like
that? Why are you digging?
Let's just pretend I'm digging.
Yeah, let's pretend you're digging. It can't. Excessive digging does break down structure, no matter what. So, you know, if you're digging to plant something, good for you. If you're wanting to improve the soil, mulch and layer in the fall.
Yeah, and if you're doing construction, bummer.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But you need to aerate that soil again. You just go out and pull a bunch of weeds out. And,
yeah.
You know, it does a nice job of loosening the soil back up.
And also remember that any plant roots in compacted soil help to break that compaction up.
Yeah.
As they grow.
Yeah. All right. You may have some calls or questions for these folks. You can give us a call at 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. You can also email us weekday at KUOW.org. Please share your thoughts on adding dolomite lime to the vegetable garden, Becky asks. I just received results from a soil test for my large raised planters showing high calcium but low magnesium content. pH is slightly acid at 6.3. A local organic fertilizer supplier recommended adding dolomite in addition to a balanced organic fertilizer. From my quick research, it seems that the practice of adding lime is somewhat debatable. Shall we debate it? What do you guys think?
I'm Laura, passing that on to Laura.
Laura, go ahead. You get to take it.
Adding lime can be a good thing for your garden. It sounds like dolomite would be a good choice in this case with the needed magnesium levels as well. Typically, adding it in the fall is a better plan. It gives time for it to really work into the soil. And if you're doing it also to affect pH of the soil, it takes time. So that's not something that's going to happen overnight. But in general, vegetable gardens do benefit from that. So it is a practice that we do recommend at Seattle Tilth. And it's good that you did the soil test because that's usually the first thing we'll tell people. Do that first. Don't just add things. Find out what you really need.
6.3 in pH. What does that tell you about the soil?
That's slightly low for a veggie garden. You can bring that up. The lime will help with that.
Yeah. What should it be?
Closer. Well, you want to get maybe closer to the 6.6, 6.8 range, ideally.
I see. Shelby writes, I started an outdoor raised veggie bed, root veggies and leafy, and wanted to know the best, easiest way to sow seeds outside. I began by poking little holes, but then just began to scoop out a row and sprinkle mini seed. I then plan to simply thin them out as they begin to grow. Is this a bad idea?
That's the easy
That's
way to do it.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
You get more food out of it that way.
Because you can eat the thinnings.
Yeah, absolutely.
For some fine seeds, I like to mix them with a potting soil. And that way you get them and kind of get them uniformly mixed in there and then make the row and then fill that row with the thin layer of potting soil. It provides a nice medium or seedling starter mix is another good one. And it provides a visual cue where the row is.
And also because the seeds are so fine, you don't have to cover them with anything else because you've mixed them in that potting soil.
Exactly. And if you pre-moisten the soil too, you don't have that problem of all of a sudden the seeds all floating out as you're trying to water them in.
Good plan.
And then it's amazing. Last year I had all my veggie seeds in one bed, all ended up washing down to the bottom corner of it because my bed wasn't level. And so I had, look, all my chard is sprouting way over there rather than in the row I put it in.
It's a new design.
Exactly.
By leveling, level.
Yeah.
Is that because you hadn't done that?
It was also due to a very heavy rainstorm that happened afterwards. But yeah, I usually don't. I'm not a person that gets out the level when I'm dealing with beds.
All right, one more email before I turn to our phones. 206-543-5869. If you have a question for our gardening panel, 1-800-289-5869. Hi, I'm interested in growing hops as a screen on the fence around my chicken yard. Can hops be grown in a horizontal direction? I also wanted to have a hops vine over the top of the yard, zigzag back and forth, as a sunscreen for my girls. Do you have any suggestions or advice on how best to do this? This is from Deanna. Any of you grown hops?
You've grown hops.
Yeah, I love growing hops, and I think that's a great idea. One thing I've learned about growing hops is that if depending on what your tolerance is for how fastidious you are as far as aesthetics, I would, if I was running horizontals, I'd probably run it on a hemp rope or gardening twine that could be removed at the end of the season, so that you can, because the hop vines will die in place. You know, they resprout from the ground each year, so if you end up with a big buildup of dead vines, so it makes it a little, and they can be. I mean, they wrap around pretty good, and it becomes quite a chore to unwind them or get the remove them afterwards. But if you have them growing on something that you can just cut off at the end and compost, then that makes it easier.
And you can have strong enough twine that it'll withstand the rigors of the weather for that summer
season. Yeah, definitely. And they grow incredibly well. So they grow horizontally. They'll grow whichever direction you point them. They have no problem.
All right. Sarah's in the Central District. Question about herbs. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Thanks
so
for calling.
I use manure compost, a full bag, and then like a third a bag of soil. Mix it together to grow herbs. And they're growing, but they're growing slowly. Is too much of the manure compost? Or?
Well, most herbs like it on the lean side. They're Mediterranean plants, sage and thyme, rosemary. They like well-draining soil. They don't like it rich. And usually when you're adding compost, they don't like a whole lot of organic matter. Now, basil is an entirely different matter. But it might be that it's just staying too wet in the soil. That could be one thing. You might want to – is this in a container?
Yes, it is. Yeah. They're in the black containers that you would, people dispose of. So.
You could repot them. Or you could just mulch with some grit, some gravel or something to keep the crowns of the plants dry. Any other ideas?
Okay.
How old are these plants?
I've been growing them it's been about a month.
Okay. Well, you still have plenty of time.
Yeah.
The weather's a little chillier than it should be this time of year, and those guys love a lot of heat. So they're just waiting for summer.
Thank you.
All right. Good. Thank you. Ken is in South Seattle. Hello, Ken.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
So many of us have moss that grows on the roofs of our houses, especially on the north side. And I have an organic yard with 8 fruit trees and a fairly large organic vegetable garden. I want to know what I can put on my roof to get rid of the moss that will not poison my yard.
I would recommend going. There's a website called Grow Smart, Grow Safe. And it has a whole list, and it takes different products, and it ranks them by toxicity, many different kinds of toxicity. And it's really a great resource for searching for different products that range, the spectrum. So they're based on everything from impacts to human health to like aquatic organisms. So it's really a good resource. I think it's at growsmartgrowsafe.org, or it comes up pretty quickly if you search.
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. It does come up. Our friend Roger Ferris would say that the best product would be to brush your roof or sweep your roof as you can, even though it does also dislodge parts of the roof. It's better than the products you could put on it. And he doesn't have a lot of faith with the zinc strip, but he has talked to people about using it and have had some success with the zinc strip, a piece of metal that you put across the top of your roof and theoretically kills the moss.
One other thing you might look at is, depending on the layout of your yard, sometimes you have a couple of people have big conifers or other trees with a limb that really shades a portion of the roof, and that might be where they have the most moss buildup. So sometimes just removing, pruning one limb off can make a difference for a certain part of your roof.
Yeah. Does that help?
Great. Yes, it all helps. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for calling. Gary's in Bellevue. Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. I've got a question about weeding. I heard the comments about both the dangers or damage of digging and the need for aeration of the soil and that weed roots can actually contribute to that. So I thought, as a total amateur, I would just tell you what I do, and you can comment on how good or bad that practice is. I use a hand cultivator or a hori-hori, and I try to loosen the roots so that I pull them completely out so that they're not going to stay there and propagate further. But I don't know if I'm doing more damage to the soil by digging that much with a cultivator or the hori-hori.
No, no, you're doing absolutely right. That's the best thing you can do. You're getting as much of the root out as possible, and you are aerating the soil in the process, even though that wasn't your original intent. But in terms of damaging soil, what you would need to actually do would be to dig and dig and dig and turn soil over. It's really the action of bringing the lower levels of soil up to the surface, and you're disturbing the ecosystem, essentially, and then you're messing up the structure of the topsoil. So when you bring the lower levels up, you move critters around that were happily living in that good organic soil on top.
And also, oftentimes people will then, when they're out there gardening, they will tamp their plant down into its planting hole. And when the soil is really, really wet, you can just squish all the air space out of it, and it just turns into a little block of cement.
All right. I like that image.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Not a best image. Haley's in Ballard. Hi, Haley.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I have a question for your guest about the best material to use for clotching raised beds and whether or not I have any non-plastic options.
Non-plastic options.
Where I can get that.
Non-plastic options for a cloche?
Horticultural fleece, as they say in England, rime. I mean, I don't know what it's made out of.
It's a polyester type fabric.
But it's not like using sheets of plastic.
No. You can do more of a cold frame design, which can act as basically as a cloche, which is, use wood products and then use surplus glass.
And then you really have to be careful because, boy, can that heat up fast.
Yes, you do. You can put, and if you're an inattentive gardener, as myself, then investing in a automatic opener that's temperature, you can get these automatic openers that are for greenhouses that you could use on a cold frame also that will, when it heats up too hot, it just lifts open the window.
Does that help you?
Yes, I already have the PVC piping in place, so your latter suggestion sounds great, but a little bit more technical than what I have. So I was just hoping there was something that I could find to sort of lay over the piping that wasn't plastic.
You know, I haven't looked into it that much yet, but there's so many new plastic-like but plant-based materials coming out. I wouldn't be surprised if there might be something out that will be out shortly, because I know that, hey, at the coffee shop, when you can get to-go cups that are totally biodegradable now, so that look like plastic. So maybe there'll be a film.
Where I might start looking for those.
Oh, I don't know if they exist, so I'm stabbing in the dark.
I would call the garden hotline. Let us do a little research for you, because that's something we would want to know about anyway, if such a thing existed, so we could advise people about it.
Okay, great.
What number should they call?
Yeah, you can call 206-633-0224.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Here, I have this email, and I showed Marty the picture. The listener, Lisa, sent this picture. I bought this bare root Asian pear last week. When I went to plant it, I saw there were very few roots. I have been watering it between downpours with VitaStart. It says it has a vitamin B+2 rooting hormone 384. You guys know what that means. Does the gardening panel think it has a chance to survive? Should I yank it out, take it back? I'm a pretty good gardener, but I'm not sure I can pull this off. Advice? So you looked at it, Marty. We'll let Greg come take a look.
It's kind of late in the season for bare root. We're kind of at the end of bare root time, first of all. And second of all, give it a try. I mean, what else are you going to do? Don't water it between rainfalls. We're getting enough water as it is. So you don't have to do that, and you don't have to give it vitamins. We can take vitamins every day. You don't have to give that to your tree. It would be better just to... let it, at this time of year, it's rare that we need to water something unless it's covered in a container and it's not getting any rain on it at all.
I would suspect that it was deeply discounted or on sale at this point.
Is that right?
Yeah. And it really doesn't have much for roots. That's a fairly sad looking tree.
But you can try.
Yeah. There's no harm in trying.
All right.
And I would recommend staking it also low and loose so that it to help hold it up, because with no roots there, it's likely to get just topple.
All right, last email question here for you, last quick question. I've been waiting for warmer weather to get potatoes in the ground, but it's getting late. Is it safe to plant them now? What's the best fertilizer to use, or just organic matter? Are you a potato planter,
I am,
Laura?
A potato planter. I haven't planted mine yet, so I think there's hope still. I'm still planning on doing mine. One piece of advice I would give you, I wouldn't worry too much about fertilizing heavily. You can use, you know, a good all-purpose granular organic fertilizer to mix in with that when you plant. But you might want to think about planting them not directly in the ground, but into a container of some sort with some kind of drainage holes in it. That's much easier to maintain, and it's easier to harvest from in the fall.
I like the idea of those big burlap bags for potatoes, because then once you harvest, you can just roll up the bag and put it away until next potato season.
You can, and the other thing about that is you don't leave pieces of tuber in the ground, and you don't run the risk of getting late blight into your garden. You can use that burlap for something else and even start with clean burlap next year. You want to be aware that burlap's going to dry out a bit, so you need to water that.
All right. That's a good way to think about the spring and the summer. That sounds great. Laura Matter has been a practicing horticulturist for 30 years. She is Garden Hotline Program Coordinator at Seattle Tilth. Marty Wingate, you can find her work about gardening and traveling at martywingate.com.
And I will be at Sky Nursery on Saturday at 11 o'clock talking about landscaping for privacy and showing good plants to use.
Which is also the title of her book. And Greg Rayburn is the Vashon Basin Steward. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Thanks for your phone calls. We just want to take you back to the top story of this day before we go into To the Point. More than 500 people from Washington registered to run Monday's Boston Marathon. Jeff Poppe of Bellevue ran past the site of the bomb blast just a few seconds before the explosion. His wife, Anita Poppe, was in the crowd a few feet away from that deadly blast. The couple told KUOW's John Ryan about their very close call.
I was about 50 to 100 feet from the finish line and was waiting there for my husband to come through.
And I was looking for her. Actually, I was looking for a sign that she had made. I said, go, Jeff, go.
And my husband came through at about four hours and 9 minutes. And
4:09, probably very close to the last person, if not the last, to get a recorded time today, because literally like a second after I crossed the line, there was this huge noise, a huge cloud of white smoke, and it seemed like some debris flying up in the air as well. I had just passed that point probably 10 seconds earlier.
The explosion, the center of it was about 15 feet behind me. It was the loudest noise I've ever heard. Just a deafening explosion. And everybody screaming behind me in the billowing smoke. But we didn't turn around and look for too long because everybody wanted to get away. All I could think was, this is a terrorist attack and we're all going to die. And then maybe 5 or 7 seconds after the first blast, the second bomb went off, and that was even closer to us. As we were running, it felt like the bombs were following us. People said, run faster, run faster. There was kind of a stampede-like attitude, so we all grabbed on to each other, their arms and shoulders and clothing, just kind of all holding each other and running.
The officials descended immediately, and they said, keep running. They just wanted everybody to get out of the area. So I ran further east. The whole time I'm running from the finish line, I just thought, what if I lost my wife because she was supporting me?
As I was running with these people, I saw my husband, and he was just standing there kind of in shock, looking around, almost like he didn't know what was going on, and I screamed his name, but I couldn't get his attention.
Then the fellow tapped me on the shoulder and said, your wife's over there.
And he practically fell over.
I think I said, I'm so glad to see you. I thought I lost you.
I was probably a second or two away from possibly being injured or losing my life, as was my husband. We have a new appreciation for the moments ahead of us.
Jeff Poppe of Bellevue ran the Boston Marathon. His wife, Anita Poppe, was in the crowd. They spoke with KUOW's John Ryan, who produced that story. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Bagano, Amin Al-Sadi, Danielle Anthony Goodwin, our intern. Bernard Ouellette is the engineer. We'll be hearing Talk of the Nation in a few moments. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. This is KUOW.
10:59. Carnival Cruise Lines says it will repay the government for the cost of Coast Guard responses to disabled Carnival cruise ships. That and, of course, an update from Boston in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Dairy Farmers of Washington, committed to producing safe, healthy milk that starts with maternity programs with pure feed and fresh water for healthy baby cows. More about what dairy families in Washington are doing to keep milk pure, fresh, and local is online at akeyingredient.com.
By the way, as Steve just briefly indicated a moment ago, in order to get the latest and best coverage of what's happening in Boston, To the Point will be preempted today by NPR's Talk of the Nation, which will begin right after the news, just a couple minutes from now.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW-Bothell Technology MBA program and the Leadership MBA program at Bellevue, featuring small classes and interactive learning environments. Online application deadline is Monday, April 22nd. Details at uwb.edu/MBA.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.